23-8104 and the related cases, Saba Capital Master Fund versus BlackRock ESG Capital. And we'll wait for everybody to move in and out of the room. Mr. Mundia.
Good morning, Your Honor. Tariq Mundia for the BlackRock Appellants. I will be addressing the substantive issues under Section 18I of the Investment Company Act. My friend Mr. Joyce will be addressing the serious questions of standing, and Mr. Cousett will be addressing the jurisdictional issues. Before I begin, Your Honor, I would like to thank the court for hearing us on an expedited basis. We do have an emergency here in the sense that we have a shareholder vote that's coming up in the summertime, and the imminence of a Saba takeover of a Maryland fund, I think, you know, is the reason that we moved for expedition, so we thank the court for doing that. This appeal really involves the imminent prospect of Saba using its 25% controlling position to take over a Maryland incorporated fund. The issue is whether, despite the requirements of Maryland's anti-takeover laws, which are designed to protect Maryland entities from the very conduct that Saba is engaged in, whether that type of conduct is prohibited by federal law. We say not. The text of Section 18I doesn't support it. The plain meaning of Section 18I doesn't support it. And the overarching preemption jurisprudence does not support it.
I mean, well, you say required by Maryland law, but obviously, you know, Maryland law has a carve-out for a corporation registered under the ICA as a closed-end investment company, and the default is that it doesn't apply. You have to opt into it, right?
Well, you can opt into the statute, which is what this fund did, but the fact that they voluntarily opted into the statute doesn't mean that the features embedded in Maryland law
so
are not otherwise
required.
So if they
opt in, it's required, but it's... But you don't have to opt in. So
right,
why is that the plain meaning of required?
There's nothing in the statute that suggests that a voluntary decision to opt in
has to be
required.
There is something in the statute. It's the word required.
Right, but the features of Maryland law with that apply to control shares here are required by Maryland law. The fact that it's voluntary at some point in the chain of events doesn't mean it's any less required. People make voluntary decisions all the time. You can voluntarily enter into contracts, but you are bound by the obligations therein. You can add employees that then result in legal requirements. There's all sorts of things that you can do on a voluntary basis. But once you do that, which is what happened here, those are requirements of the Maryland law. Unlike Nuveen, the other thing that...
Yeah, but the Maryland law doesn't say that it's irrevocable and it's for all time. I mean, so even if I embrace this argument, which I'm not sure I do, that if you make a decision at time one, it becomes a requirement, the Maryland law requires you to opt in, allows you to opt in and end opt out, right?
It does, but in the exercise of your fiduciary duties, and that is a requirement. But that's not the issue in this case. The issue in this case is, did their fiduciary duties require them to opt in? And they made a determination, the Maryland law, yes, our fiduciary duties require us to opt in because...
Well, that's a different argument. You're saying Maryland law requires it because the funds here determine that it's... because their fiduciary duties required them to opt in. Yeah, but I mean, obviously, if you determine that your fiduciary duties require you to do something that's unlawful, you can't do it, right?
For sure.
So that just begs the question, doesn't it?
For sure, but here I think we have two arguments. One is that you've got the voluntary decision, but you also have the textual reason. Their reasoning would read out the word otherwise. If you look at Section 18A, which is the intro to Section 18I, it makes it very clear that except as provided in Section 18A, or otherwise provided by law. If you look at Section 18A, which has to be read in the context of 18I, there you do have a voluntary submission You voluntarily issue senior securities, and that's...
Well, that's true. I mean, there's these particular circumstances where you're raising money for the fund. But why does that read out the word otherwise?
Because 18I
says, except as provided in subsection A of this section or as otherwise required by law. So except as provided in subsection A with these two options you have under that subsection, or aside from that, which is what otherwise means, what's required by law.
Otherwise may mean a couple of things. It could mean in the same vein as. So look at 18I
it's an exception to the general rule of subsection I.
Or you could say in other ways, like. And if you look at 18A is very clear. You can issue senior securities.
You're focused on this arguable reading of the word otherwise, but like I'm more struck by the difference between provided in subsection A and required by law. I mean, shouldn't we give meaning to that distinction as well?
Not particularly, because I don't think it would make any difference here as to whether they use
provided
or required.
So even though otherwise has multiple definitions, you're saying we have to adopt yours.
Well,
but even though Congress is using two different words, we should treat them as basically equivalent.
Well, I think what we're saying is that on either interpretation of otherwise, it doesn't exclude voluntary acts. That's the first point. The second point is whether the word provided or required is used wouldn't make a difference to our argument. What they are saying is that otherwise must exclude voluntary acts, and there's nothing in the statute that supports that.
I think the argument is that required excludes voluntary acts. Right. So if we're not focused on otherwise, we're focused on required, does that make a difference?
Is it required today? Is it required presently? That's the analysis.
I think we have that argument. You've reserved some time for rebuttal, so we'll hear from you again. We'll turn to the next appellant, Mr. Joyce.
Good morning, Judge Menasche, Judge Lee, and may it please the court, I'm Eamon Joyce on behalf of Royce Global Value Trust. Plaintiff's claim against Royce should have been dismissed for lack of Article III standing. Plaintiff's assertion that it will experience future injury as to Royce shares is wildly speculative. It has no resemblance to the circumstances in Nuveen, and that's where I'd like to start, right? Nuveen at page 111 lays out these three Romanets for why it was finding imminent harm. None of them apply here. It says, Saba established, one, a pattern of increasing its ownership in Nuveen funds for over a two-year period before the amendment. Here, you don't have either of those things. Stagnant ownership, all ownership post-amendment. Two, intent to purchase additional shares but for the amendment. Those aren't magic words, which is what the district court seemed to take them as. When you read down in Nuveen at pages 112 and 113, the court's reasoning shows why it could credit the declaration pleadings and why nothing like that is here. It said Saba bought millions of shares in Nuveen's funds from 2018 to 2020 at levels high enough to trigger the amendment.
So you're saying in Nuveen it's much more plausible that they're going to buy additional shares, whereas here it's more like someday intentions?
Someday intentions. I think that's right.
Even if they are buying up shares of all of these funds, I mean, it does seem like that is generally their MO, isn't it?
So their MO is generally to buy shares of funds that they consider underperforming. I think if you look at their declaration.
Like, when would it matter, right? So I understand in Nuveen we have this like 9.9% threshold, and that's pretty dramatic, and maybe it makes it more clear. But certainly if you only own a little bit, if you think that your voting rights are not going to be honored, you might not buy, even go from 2% to 3%. So if you're deterred from buying anything more because your ultimate objective would always be to reach 10% because that's your strategy, then why isn't it that you are chilled or deterred even from buying more when you're at a low percentage?
Let me make sure I understand Your Honor's question. Are you asking specifically whether deterrence is present injury, or are you asking it through the lens of imminent? I think if we're in present injury.
It's either one.
Okay.
So that you have a present injury because you want to buy more, but like you're not going to pursue this company if it's not going to honor your voting shares. But if you knew that it would, maybe you'd buy up a lot more quickly. So it could be a present injury, or it could be an imminent injury.
So in present injury, I'd say the district court didn't go there. I think it'd have to go back down on present injury out of the gate. I don't think that interest is concrete. I think we've laid out some cases why a desire to do something is not deemed sufficiently concrete. Here, it also wouldn't be particularized as to Royce, especially given the history we have. And then I think, to Your Honor's point about which is almost like spotting them imminent. I don't think it works under Lujan, which put a lot of focus on the when. I think when Your Honor considered...
Well, Lujan put a lot of focus on whether it was going to happen or not going to happen, right? And so in Lujan, they just said, I like seeing the animals, and I plan to do so someday.
So,
but here they actually have bought some shares.
But we
have a history of buying up a lot of shares at reaching 10%, and so it seems more plausible... Or less like someday intentions than Lujan
does. I'm not sure it
Maybe
does.
Get them over the line.
I'm not sure it does, Judge Menasche. And let me say this, right? They plead themselves. That it often takes them months or years to build a position, right? It's 2 years in Nuveen to build that position. That looks like someday intentions.
Which way does that cut? So if it is a long-term strategy, doesn't that mean you have to plan early on?
And so
it might frustrate the strategy even if you're at an earlier point.
No, Your Honor, I think it actually gets worse for them, right? If you look at the circumstances here, just take the three funds that challenge standing. To get to 10% on those three funds is roughly $165 million expenditure. But of course, their declaration doesn't say that. They say they're going to get to 10% of everything. It's $300 million that they're saying they're going to put out of pocket over a period of years. And then we all know that things can change over the course of years. And
we know that 9.9% is enough, and that could show imminence, and 2% is too little. Where would we draw the principle that we're applying?
So I don't. Let me push back on 2% not categorically not being enough. I think it's the facts that matter, right? If you had a holder at 2% that said, similar to the situation my friends at BlackRock find themselves in, if you had a holder at 2% that said, this company is being, in our view, badly mismanaged, we want to affect a change in ownership, we would go to 40% tomorrow, right? You have a declaration that says we have allotted funds to get ourselves to 40% or frankly to 10.1%. That's what we want to do. Then I think it's a very different case. Your Honor doesn't have that.
It's kind of a claim where they're looking at a universe of funds and they're deciding which ones to invest in to go up to 10%. You're saying they can't actually bring this kind of claim unless they actually pick one that they're going to do and intend specifically there to do 10%. They can't just say, we're deterred from all of them because of this problem, and so we can't implement our strategy.
I just think the line drawing on the other side, it becomes impossible, Your Honor. 25 states have control share provisions. Saba has a lot of money. Is every company in every one of these 25 states that has a control share provision potentially a defendant because Saba says, maybe I'd invest, I've invested 10% in other funds? I just don't see it.
In terms of the reality, it makes sense that they would just be thinking about which one to invest in, and this issue might make a difference. And so if they in fact did just pick one to invest in, you know, maybe even for the purpose of challenging the control share provision, it seems like that's a requirement that they spend a lot of resources on one thing where they don't actually know whether they can invest or not.
But Your Honor, I'm not saying they have to... I'm not saying they have to spend the resources. I think, and look, Lujan doesn't require the plaintiff to have the plane ticket.
So if they had just said, here's this one fund, and if we and we intend to go to 10% tomorrow if the limitation on voting was not there, they would then have standing.
I think you might require – tomorrow gets you a lot closer, right? That's the when. I think if you look at cases like – this court's case in Calcano, right, applying Lujan in those cases, that's a case where all the plaintiff had to buy was a single gift card, and the plaintiff was saying, I would do this immediately, and said, I live in the Bronx, I'd go down to Columbus Circle to buy the gift card. And this court said immediately wasn't good enough there, that more detail was needed to make that claim plausible. Here you're talking about the expenditure of millions of dollars, so I think saying, we intend to spend millions, really, if you put it together with her declaration, $300 million.
Maybe it's not plausible that you or I are going to spend millions in an imminent time period, but it's not so implausible for a large fund, right?
But this is, Your Honor, where I think it moves together with the year's position. Because, you know...
So they have said that it's a long-term strategy.
It's a long-term strategy. They plead that it's under current market conditions. Today, as we sit here, Royce is up 20% in a one-year period. It's up 9%. I mean, this isn't a suicide pact, Your Honor. given Saba's investment strategies, I would hope that if Royce is up another 20%, that Saba's plan is not to change ownership of Royce. And this is where, and stepping back, right, they haven't pleaded as to Royce, unlike as to BlackRock, what they intend to do. But this just becomes one speculative condition on another. We don't know what's going to happen in the months that follow, let alone in the years that follow, while they may or may not accumulate a position. Okay. Thank you for your indulgence.
We have that argument. We'll turn next to the next appellant, Mr. Kosed.
Kosed, Your Honor. Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Brian Kosed for Cain O'Gates LLP on behalf of the Adams Fund's defendants, addressing the jurisdictional issues, and my co-counsel Stuart Webb, representing the Tortoise Funds from Venable, will be addressing those issues on rebuttal. The district court found that the Adams and Tortoise Funds transact business under the 40 Act and were subject to jurisdiction under CPLR 302A1 based on two pieces of record evidence: that our clients list their stock on the stock exchange and that they use brokers who may have offices in New York or who may be based in New York. That's it. The district court didn't cite any case with analogous or comparable facts to support its holding on that point, nor does Saba cite any in its opposition brief dealing with comparable facts. Looking at the case law, this isn't enough either to transact business under the 40 Act or the other statutes that apply that test or under CPLR 302A1. Look at the cases under transacts business. The Supreme Court in Kodak said twice in its decision that Kodak was engaged in a continuous course of business in the Atlanta area. Therefore, they were transacting business in the Northern District of Georgia. In Scofany, the Supreme Court said multiple times in its decision that the British parent was engaged in continuing intensive activities.
But what do you use brokers in New York to do?
Well, there's very little in the record evidence on that in this case, Your Honor. For my clients, the Adams Funds, we noted that we make payments to certain businesses based in New York. One of them was Bloomberg, for a Bloomberg subscription, and to certain brokers who are headquartered in New York.
You hire a broker in New York to pay your Bloomberg subscription?
No, Your Honor, no. I'm, those are two different points.
Oh, it's a different thing. You have brokers in New York. But are
we have
brokers in New York the ones that sell shares that, you know, Saba might be purchasing?
No, Your Honor.
So
I think that's an important...
Saba purchases the shares, who is it transacting with?
That's a great question, Your Honor, and I believe that's a question for Mr. Musico. There's no evidence in the record as to where any brokers are...
sell shares to somebody who's buying them. Where is that person located who's selling the shares?
Well, these are closed-end funds, Your Honor. So the shares were put up. My clients have been listed on the stock exchange since 1867 and 1930. And the shares have been traded on the stock exchange. When Saba went and bought its shares of my clients, they didn't buy them from us. They bought them from third parties on the market. We don't know who they bought them from. So we have no, there's nothing in the record on that. And that's what's so problematic about the district court's decision. Essentially, it's saying, if you list on the stock exchange and you have separately, not to do with the actual dispute, but just your business uses brokers who may have offices in New York, that's enough either to transact business, even though the case law says otherwise.
If the purchase happens on the exchange with a third party, haven't you decided to enter into the, like, to put your shares out for a purchase in that kind of arrangement?
It's certainly true, Your Honor, that our clients chose to list on the stock exchange, and at least as to my clients, that decision was made before the 40 Act was even passed. Whether or not that's enough to subject a company to jurisdiction, the test under the transacts business test is whether it's everyday business of a substantial character. That's what the Supreme Court said in Kodak and Scofany. And that's not present as to listing on the stock exchange. And if you look at the Southern District's decision...
There's like many appellants, but are you making an argument about both personal jurisdiction and venue, or you're focused only on venue?
Great question, Your Honor. It's linked in this particular instance. Under the 40 Act...
Well, I guess because I was going to ask about what the district court said about nationwide service of process.
So yes, that...
Maybe you could address that point.
Sure, absolutely, Your Honor. If you look at the jurisdictional provision in the 40 Act, it's substantially identical to the provision in 15 U.S.C. 22 in the Clayton Act. Both of them identify venues where a case can be brought, and then both say, and process in such cases may be served, and then it provides for nationwide service. So we're not challenging that the 40 Act says nationwide service is available. But under this court's decision in Daniel, interpreting the Clayton Act, which again is substantially identical, nationwide service is only available in such cases. And this court in Daniel interpreted that to mean in such venued cases, where there is a, where the case is brought in one of the venues specified here in the 40 Act.
The case couldn't be brought here both because you don't transact business in New York for purposes of the Act and because you haven't availed yourself of New York.
That's right, Your Honor. Once you get past the venue issue, if we don't transact business here, the only thing they can rely on to establish personal jurisdiction is our New York contacts. And again, the only New York contacts in the record for my clients are at Joint Appendix 376 and for Mr. Webb's client at 372 to 373. It's very meager contacts, Your Honor. And this court has repeatedly held, at least in the context of New York law and the CPLR, that companies have substantial latitude to list on the stock exchange without subjecting themselves to New York jurisdiction. And the district court's decision basically overlooked that in favor of throwing us in with everyone else.
Okay. I see I'm, thank you very much, Mr. Costa. We'll turn to the
yes,
last
thank you, Your
appellant.
Honor.
No, we have one more appellant. No, we don't?
No, yeah.
Oh, he's only doing the rebuttal. Okay, there's three. All right. We'll turn to the appellee, Mr. Musico.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honors. Mark Musico on behalf of Saba. Your Honors, the district court properly concluded that the result in this case is in every material respect controlled by Judge Wedgley and Judge Park's well-reasoned decision in Nuveen just last year. Saba's target in this case is exactly the same target that was at issue in Nuveen.
Wait, sorry, just give me one second. The time is not counting down. I just wanted to... Okay, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. Saba's target in this case is exactly the same target as it was in Nuveen. Resolutions in the fund's governing documents voluntarily adopted that discriminate with respect to shareholders' voting rights in exactly the manner that this court found.
I get that, but we didn't have this provision, or there wasn't a focus on this provision otherwise required by law. I mean, you recognize that that is an exception.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if Maryland did require them to have the control share provisions, you would say that it's exempt?
And we would submit, Your Honor, that there is no reasonable construction of the Maryland Control Share Act that requires these funds to impose control share provisions or to otherwise discriminate with respect to voting rights such that they can benefit.
Well, why does that matter? So under Section A of the statute, you know, there's no provision that requires them to issue securities as collateral for debt or the do the preferred shares that's allowed under subsection A. But if they do, you know, the law specifies how you do it. So why doesn't the Maryland law work the same way?
So, Your Honor, the Maryland law is fundamentally different from the provisions of Section 18A. Defendant's whole argument is that once you make the voluntary choice to opt in, they are somehow required to do something under Maryland law. Defendants also implore the court to actually examine the control share provisions themselves, which we hope the court will do because they belie defendant's own argument. If you look at ECAT's own declaration, which is at page 539 of the joint appendix, even after opting in to the Control Share Act, ECAT's declaration includes a provision that authorizes its board to exempt any transaction whatsoever from the operation of the act, so much for anything being required once they're opted in.
The Maryland law in subsection A1 says holders of control shares of the corporation acquired in a control share acquisition have no voting rights with respect to the control shares except to the extent approved by the stockholders at a meeting held under 3704 of this subtitle by the affirmative vote of two-thirds of all the votes. So you're saying because they can come up with whatever arrangement they want for limiting the voting rights, then there's no requirement of Maryland law.
There's still no requirement.
But you have to do these particular things, right? You have to have a two-thirds vote and you have to have a meeting under 3704, right?
No, Your Honor. These funds can still...
You don't have to do
that? No, they can modify these provisions in any way they see fit. And again, if you continue to look at the resolutions adopted by these funds, ECAT's declaration in particular goes on. It exempts preferred shares from the operation of the Control Share Act. Other funds...
Well, that would be except to the extent approved by the stockholders. But does something in the declarations tell me they did not in fact have a meeting held under Section 3704 of the subtitle by the affirmative vote of two?
No, Your Honor. These are completely independent, adopted before any particular transactions were at issue. So there was not even an opportunity for a shareholder vote. ECAT in particular, as we've noted, is egregious because ECAT was exempted from the operation of the control share statute altogether when it opted in. At the time, Maryland's law only applied to corporations, but ECAT, of course, is a statutory trust. And that's why, as you see in ECAT's declaration, it has to include language that the Control Share Act was adopted, quote, to the same extent as if the trust were a Maryland corporation. ECAT then tries to rely on a later amendment to the Maryland statute in 2023, which allows statutory trusts formed after 2023 to opt in. But again, the key language there says such trusts may adopt control share provisions. And this is where defendants want up to be down and in to be out. They want may to mean shall.
Maryland tells them that they must have control share provisions, and exactly how it is, it's never going to be required by law.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I couldn't hear you.
So unless Maryland tells the funds that they must have control share provisions and also provides exactly what those provisions dictate, it's always going to be required. It's never going to be required by law.
Your Honor, we likely would take that position, but
Maryland law required control share provisions but didn't specify, you know, the nature of them. If we think that the ICA prohibits control share provisions, then if Maryland required some kind of control share provisions, you wouldn't have a basis for saying, well, it needs to be more permissive than you've chosen, right? At that point, Maryland law would have required something inconsistent with the ICA, and that would be enough.
I think we would agree in that circumstance, Your Honor, that there is an actual requirement. We still would make the argument that Section 18I's proviso is best read to apply only to other requirements of federal law, and that, to some extent, flows directly from.
You think it's only required? It's only federal law.
And I'm sorry.
It's only requirements of federal law. I mean, in 1940, when it was adopted, I mean, weren't most of the laws governing, corporate form? State law?
So, Your Honor, this flows from a number of different sources of the text of the ICA. For one thing, there are plenty of provisions where Congress specified state law specifically was carved out. It flows directly from defendants' arguments about, quote, otherwise required by law. If otherwise really means similar to Section 18A, why doesn't it also mean similar to Section 18A?
I mean, you think that otherwise just means different from. It doesn't mean that it has to be exactly the same as subsection A. That's not your argument for the other issue. Right?
But taking defendants' own argument, Your Honor, I'm saying if otherwise means similar, it should mean similar not only in structure, but also with respect to applying only to federal law. And again, Your Honors don't need to decide this issue for purposes of this appeal, but let me give you a hypothetical to demonstrate this point. If a state came in and said, no shareholders of closed-end funds shall be allowed to vote, that starts to look a lot less like room for traditional state corporate regulation and a lot more like nullification of federal law. It just can't possibly be what Congress intended. Your Honors, I have to emphasize that Section 18A operates fundamentally differently from the Control Share Act. Section 18A says you cannot issue preferred shares unless you meet certain conditions.
The subsection A is about bringing new money into the fund in ways that don't entrench the board.
Well,
right?
Even on the terms of whether it's an actual requirement, right, Your Honors, right? So if you look, by contrast, at the Maryland statute, Section 3-702, the Maryland statute exempts closed-end funds registered under the Act unless they opt in. Meaning,
right. In
18A, you have the provision, no preferred shares unless you meet certain conditions, which defendants say are requirements. Under the Maryland Act, it says no Control Share Act.
So if the defendants here were covered by subsection A of the Maryland Act so that they had to opt out, you're saying that it would be required by law?
Your Honors, again, you don't need to decide that question for purposes of this appeal.
Because it's an opt-in.
But No, Your Honors. We still would take the position that the funds are under no requirements in that circumstances because Maryland still gives them complete liberty to comply with federal law, and we believe that's the most reasonable construction of the proviso.
Okay, well, why don't you, before you run out of time, we talk about the standing and the jurisdiction question.
Yes, Your Honors.
With respect, what about the standing? Isn't it just someday intentions that you're going to ever reach 10% ownership in these funds?
It is not, Your Honor, and I couldn't agree more with my friend Mr. Joyce when he said it's the facts that matter. And the Saba's standing here is premised on far more than a boilerplate allegation of someday intentions.
But isn't it premised on a bit less than what was present in Nuveen? Because the one thing that sticks out in my mind is that in that case, we did say that there were, well, in ruling that there were standing, we did look to the three factors of, you know, how automatic the effect of the provision is, and a stated intention of buying more, and an increasing pattern of purchasing shares. That was one of the three factors. And so in Nuveen, you had this two-year period of steadily increasing amounts of shares. Here, I mean, for some of these entities, maybe that's present, but it feels like there's just, okay, here are all these companies, and we've got shares of all of them. Some it's 2%, some it's 9, some it's 10. There's no showing of a pattern. And so the idea that there is standing for all of them when, as you started out by saying, it is kind of a fact-based, you look at the individuals, and it seems like what you have here is you have this declaration, but then across these different entities, I don't necessarily think they are all the same.
So, Your Honor, I agree. And the district court was clear-eyed about the fact that Saba's I think its phrasing was the imminence of Saba's injury was not as apparent with respect to certain funds as it was with respect to its investments in Nuveen. But respectfully, I would submit that all of the components that supported Saba's standing in Nuveen are also present here. First and foremost, the one that defendants never grapple with, not in their briefs, not in Mr. Joyce's argument today, are their own concessions about Saba's intentions. Nuveen called this an implicit concession.
That the idea that they have a view of what Saba is and does, that they, okay, this is what they do. They go up and they try to buy up all these companies. That still does not establish that, okay, with regard to this set of 16 or 18, whatever the number is, that they've shown enough that, you know what, if this provision weren't in effect, we would in fact go out. I mean, we have this declaration that says we'd like to do this. And so I do wonder what is the limiting principle here. If all it requires is that you have a reputation for being that kind of company, and that you purchase a share and say, I want to get more, what is the limiting principle?
Respectfully, Your Honor, it's not just a reputation. It is, as Nuveen put it, this court in Nuveen put it, a demonstrated track record. And again, the court
there differences even in terms of how easily that can be done with regard to different funds,
yes.
Correct? It's not as if you can just... It can be more difficult.
You have a demonstrated track record of buying up lots of funds, but you don't have standing to sue every fund in the country on the theory that sometime in the next 100 years you're going to buy 10% ownership stake in them, right?
Your Honor, I think I would agree with that, but again, you have
to
take...
You would agree with that?
Well, again, there... This goes to a point where there are only so many closed-end funds in the country. It's actually a relatively finite number.
Oh, you're saying because the MO is specific to closed-end funds, you actually are going to go after all of them in the country. Is that your argument?
Just so the court is aware, if for context, there are only about 400 closed-end funds in the country.
So you only have standing to sue 400 funds right now because of your track record.
So... Your Honor, in addition to actually having to make an investment in certain of those funds, and for Saba's portfolio manager to be able to testify under...
So if you make one investment and you have like a 2% stake, why is that enough to say it's imminent that you're going to be deprived of voting rights if the voting rights limitation doesn't kick in until you reach 10%?
So,
and by your own admission, reaching 10% might take years.
So a number of reasons, Your Honor, and it to some extent goes to the deterrence point you were discussing with Mr. Joyce before. Mr. Joyce came up here and said this would be a different case if we came in and said we would go to 40% tomorrow. But of course, as Mr. Joyce has to admit, we can't. This is a long-term process. And so in addition to having the track record...
Well, when I made that suggestion to Mr. Joyce, he said the district court didn't rely on that. And if we do think that there's some kind of present deterrence from pursuing your investments, it would have to go back to the district court. Is that right?
This court can, of course, affirm on any grounds that are apparent in the record, and we have cited numerous cases where...
But is that your argument? It's not that there's an imminent risk of being subject... I mean, you're allowed to make alternative arguments, which probably that's what you'll say, but these are two separate arguments, which is... There's either an imminent risk that you're going to be subjected to the voting rights limitation, or there's a present injury that you're deterred from pursuing investments in these funds.
You're absolutely right, Your Honor.
Do you think that there are both things?
We do believe there are both things. We believe imminence is established in the same manner as Univine, given defendants' concessions, given Saba's track record with respect to investments in closed-end funds.
You know, and again, Univine... about being presently deterred. I mean, usually that's in like the First Amendment context where somebody's deterred from speaking. And we don't just sort of say that they're deterred from speaking on any kind of subject that might occur to them. It's usually because they have a track record and they want to say a particular thing that's going to be penalized. So, I mean... You can't be deterred from investing in all 400 funds, can you? What's the limiting principle there?
So again, Your Honor, we do Saba's portfolio manager has testified under oath about Saba's intentions with respect to these funds. If he couldn't testify to those things honestly, he wouldn't do it, right?
So you're saying that your position is you pursue these long-term investment strategies. And if your voting rights aren't going to be respected, you have to take this investment off the table, and that prevents you from engaging in a transaction you otherwise might or would engage in.
And the testimony in this case, Your Honor, is...
That was a question. Isn't it accurate to say you might engage in it? We don't know for sure that you're going to go to 10% in all of these funds, right?
The under oath testimony credited by the district court is that Saba would with respect to these funds. But then I do have to make
these
the other
funds point. That who are the defendants?
Who are the defendants, exactly. There's a sworn declaration as to each fund named as a defendant. If we're
that
talking about some...
That they are capable of getting to 10% in each
and
fund.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Judge.
I'm sorry. That Saba would and is capable of getting to 10% in all of these funds.
Absolutely. And as you say that, Your Honor, it reminds me, Judge Menasche, of your concurrence in the Fesorp case. Saba is absolutely ready and able to take the steps to participate in this process to buy the shares, which will trigger the discriminatory provisions.
And you've said that, though? Was that in the record below? I guess that's my other concern. We have the declaration saying what Saba's intentions are, but some of these other issues, and particularly with regard to the companies where it's a very... small number of shares, and it's hard to obtain to obtain additional shares, as you acknowledge. That nonetheless, you want to do it. You've said you've done it. That should be enough to give you standing.
Mr. Kazarian's declaration, Your Honor, is unequivocal about this. He says Saba would. It's paragraph 27 of his declaration. It was attached to the complaint. It was attached to the motion for summary judgment with respect to these funds. He has testified to that under oath. I also have
so
to make...
We'll get to the jurisdiction. It's okay. We have questions and you'll stay as long as we do. But I appreciate your reading my separate opinion. But in the affirmative action cases, the injury is the denial of the equal opportunity to compete in a fair process, that there's discrimination. And if we were to extend it to this context, you're basically saying anybody who engages in transactions in this market has suffered an injury because the looming threat of control shares out there makes the whole market unfair. Is that your argument?
So let me say it's not our primary argument,
okay.
Your Honor, here is where, again, it's important to consider the totality of the record. This is not about anyone in the universe who buys a single share in any given fund and it's the first time they've ever done it, and they just state they have no demonstrated resources, they have no track record, they just come in, they buy a share, they try to sue. That is not our record. We have Saba sworn testimony under oath. We have a track record of accumulating significant stakes in closed-end funds.
But this idea of the reputation in your track record, if someone came along, a billionaire who has no experience, has not previously engaged in this, buys shares in some closed-end funds, submits an affidavit saying, I absolutely intend to buy more and I'm deterred from this, they don't have the reputation, they haven't done it before, do they have standing?
It would be a much more difficult case, Your Honor, and that's why it is Saba's, and this is exactly what the court held in Nuveen at 88 F4th at 111 and 112 note 6. The court looked both at Saba's investments as to other Nuveen funds where Saba had accumulated greater than 10%, and it looked to SABA's activity with respect to non-Nuveen closed-end funds where SABA had accumulated greater than 10%. And so that historical track record is certainly important and a key piece of the standing analysis here, because it's what confirms for the court that there are more than just someday intentions or speculations here. It makes it concrete and imminent.
We should find it plausible that SABA will buy 10% ownership stake in all of these funds.
The testimony, Your Honor, that Mr. Kazarian gave is that given market conditions at the time he swore to his declaration, SABA would, if these control
shares... So if, in fact, your strategy takes years and you're saying if current market conditions hold, we will eventually have 10%, I mean...
So
it doesn't seem like it's not... I can't be confident that you actually are going to own 10% of each fund.
Your Honor, the same might have been true while SABA was waiting for the control share provision dispute to be resolved in Nuveen.
Because market conditions might have changed dramatically.
Exactly. And that's exactly... Your Honor, if I could just make one last point, because I want to make sure to make clear. The Nuveen court said one last thing that's important to the standing analysis here as to current injury. And Nuveen recognized that an interference with the shareholders' quote, real-time investment decisions is a concrete, cognizable harm. And there...
That's the deterrence point that we were talking about.
It's a variation, I think, on the deterrence point, Your Honor. And it's fundamental to our free market system. When shareholders like SABA have this record of buying and selling shares, they need to understand what their rights are when they're investing in these funds.
Yeah, but standing is fundamental to our judicial system, so those are different. But anyway, so let's talk about personal jurisdiction and venues. So is it enough that the defendants just list their shares on the New York Stock Exchange?
Your Honor, it is for purposes of actor transaction venue and for specific jurisdiction under New York law. So defendants blur two separate concepts here. And so just let me set the stage a little bit to make sure we're on the same page. They agree that their minimum contacts with the United States are sufficient to establish personal jurisdiction. So the only question then is whether we've sued in a permissible venue under the ICA, which they say is what's required to allow nationwide service of process.
That's the only question. I mean, it is true that there are some circuits who have this idea that if a statute authorizes nationwide service of process, that it's only a connect with the whole country. But we haven't said that.
Not specifically with respect.
And Mr. Kosed was saying that if you look at the statute, it just sort of says you have venue wherever you might otherwise bring a case. So it doesn't, that provision doesn't by itself expand the universe of contacts. So I guess just another way of saying, so if in fact we didn't agree with that principle and we thought you needed to show personal jurisdiction or purposeful availment of New York, have you shown that here?
Your Honor, the district court certainly found that we did based on and that is where, so just to make sure that the two concepts are clear, the specific jurisdiction and actor transaction analysis is premised on the listing on the New York Stock Exchange and defendants' purposeful availment of the New York jurisdiction in that respect, and the fact that SABA's claims are pertain to its rights as a shareholder, meaning they arise from the acquisition of shares on the New York Stock Exchange. The district court, this point was raised below, and the district court noted that defendants did not contest that SABA's purchase was on the New York Stock Exchange. I do want to make sure that
the mere listing of something on the New York Stock Exchange would impose any entity to personal jurisdiction in New York because they're selling something on the New York Stock Exchange?
Your Honor, in the context of federal securities claims, that is a wholly unremarkable proposition. There is a reason that this court is the center of federal securities litigation, because specifically with respect to actor transaction venue, any non-trivial act in furtherance of the wrong is sufficient to establish venue.
For venue, but that's not necessarily for personal jurisdiction.
Well, and I apologize, Your Honor, if I've gone back, but I don't think there's disagreement that we are able to avail ourselves of nationwide service of process, provided we can establish venue in this district. And given the extraordinarily...
So nationwide service of process is different from whether it comports with the due process limitations on personal jurisdiction, right?
Yes, Your Honor. But again, I also don't think there is a dispute. In fact, I know there is not a dispute that defendants concede nationwide contacts are sufficient.
My understanding of the argument I just heard was that they don't necessarily concede that that's the relevant analysis, it's just nationwide contacts?
No. So for
they do concede that.
I think they do concede that, but then for venue, the dispute really is for venue purposes. Have we shown a transaction of business in SDNY or an actor transaction or purposeful availment under New York law?
Okay, so what is the transacting business in New York in SDNY?
So
they list on the stock exchange, but you buy the shares from a third party.
So with respect to transacting business, and again, this is where it's important to distinguish the two concepts. For purposes of transacting business, they argue at this straw man. They try to say we're trying to claim the funds transact business merely by listing their shares on the New York Stock Exchange. That's not the argument. That's not what the district court found. For purposes of transacting business, the district court did exactly what this court instructed in Daniel, consistent with the Supreme Court's decision in Scofany, which is to undertake a realistic assessment of the ordinary nature of defendant's business. And the ordinary nature of defendant's business is to do nothing but buy and sell securities. Again, this is not about listing of their own securities. All they do is invest. They buy and sell securities. And their own affidavits from their corporate representatives admit that they buy and sell those securities through brokers in New York. There's nothing else to their business, and that was the basis on which the district court concluded there was a transaction of business in New York for purposes of venue. To the extent there's any doubt about that, I want to make sure to point out that in the Dorchester decision cited by the district court in its page 39 of the special appendix, note 11, any doubts about that, the affidavits and the pleadings need to be construed in the light most favorable to SABA, and doubts resolved in SABA's favor for purposes of defendant's personal jurisdiction motion.
Litigation, we apply the presumptions about jurisdiction that we apply to the merits. We make inferences in favor of the plaintiff, and so on. But eventually, if it turns out that they don't transact business, you wouldn't deny that it would turn out that venue was improper.
But the facts already established
that.
We agree.
Okay.
Unless your honors have other questions.
Mr. Musico, we'll turn to the first rebuttal, Mr. Mungia.
Thank you, Your Honor. With respect to ECAT, I think the evidence is pretty clear. If you look at the Declaration of Trust, there is just a simple opt-out provision in the Declaration. There's a exemption provision, but in terms of the first sentence, it's an opt-in, and they say we opt into the statute.
Yeah, what's pretty remarkable about it is actually the first sentence. It says, okay, we set up this rule that requires you to opt out. And then, but you know, for companies, closed-end funds under the ICA, we're not going to apply that rule to them. We're going to change it into an opt-in. So isn't that like Maryland saying, look, we don't want to interfere with the ICA. We want to allow you to comply.
No, I think what Maryland did in 2000 is it allowed the controlled share statute to apply to investment companies. So it was a recognition that investment companies would be bound by the Maryland controlled share statute. And in 2021, the boards decided in the exercise of fiduciary duties to adopt those features of the statute. It's not like Nuveen. It's not a bylaw where they lay it out. They basically say we're opting into the statute,
and all of the features of the statute. What about Mr. Musico's argument that actually it doesn't define what the control share provisions look like? You have discretion to define them in all sorts of ways.
With respect, we think it does. It basically says that you need a two-thirds shareholder vote to allow those shares to vote. That's the defining feature of the control share provisions.
Okay, so because that is required.
Exactly.
Required by law.
Exactly. And so their interpretation would read out the words otherwise. And overlaying all of this is the notion that state law is there to regulate takeovers. And this is a takeover, make no mistake about it. And their interpretation is perhaps it's correct, perhaps it's not. But where there is a tie like that, Congress has said that preemption needs to be clear and manifest. And that most certainly is not what you see in 18i. You would need to have words that show that there's a clear intention to preempt state law. And that you don't see here. You have this word otherwise required by law. And when there's a tie under well-established preemption law, we win.
Okay. I think we have that argument. Thank you, Mr. Lazia. Mr. Joyce.
Thank you, Judge Menashe. Let me start with a declaration, which for our purposes is essentially the same as the pleadings. Let's go to paragraph 27, right? The would acquire. I think you're right, Judge Menashe, that it's got a conditional built in to it. It hedges it off the bat. And even if it didn't, it's no different from Calcano and what this court did on the pleadings. They're exact same thing. And this court said plaintiff's conclusory allegations of the factors we found relevant in this other ADA case, relevant to ADA, Article III standing in ADA cases, are insufficient to establish standing. So too here. They've just invoked the Nuveen factor without any facts around it. And if anything, I think the facts are better, as I said, in Calcano. I have purchased in the past a gift card, and I would immediately do so again if you offered Braille gift cards. That feels much less speculative than talking about spending hundreds of millions of dollars. My friend Mr. Musico went to Faceorp. I think that's less conclusory than this is, right? We applied to NYU. We submitted articles to NYU, and we would do so again. But for this policy.
The problem in that case was it wasn't clear that there were any individuals who actually did that. So that, I mean, here you don't deny that there exists a SAPA Master Capital Fund, right?
Correct. But I think that goes to Judge Lee's questions about the pattern. And I think that takes us back to where Mr. Musico started at the very beginning. What he said was SAPA's target is identical to that in Nuveen, companies that have adopted control share provisions. That's not the target in Nuveen. SAPA was an investor in Nuveen before it ever adopted a control share provision. In Royce, he's right. In 2021, Royce adopts a control share provision. SAPA doesn't have any investments through 2022. Looks a lot worse than Faceorp. Looks a lot worse than my friends in Calcano. And then what happens? Oh, oral argument in Nuveen, June 14th, 2023. 15 days later, they sue Royce. It's not anything like Nuveen. It's an entirely different case, and the facts aren't here to support Article III standing. The case should be dismissed on those grounds.
Thank you very much, Mr. Joyce. Mr. Webb.
Thank you, Your Honor. Stuart Webb on behalf of the Tortoise Funds and also speaking today for the Adams Funds in rebuttal. I heard Mr. Musico argue that somehow we are transacting business in New York because we're listed on the New York Stock Exchange. The listing on the New York Stock Exchange has nothing to do with this case. The allegation that somehow...
I think Mr. Musico said that you transact business in New York because your business is buying and selling securities, and you do that through a broker in New York.
Okay, that's true. But what he started with was the buying and selling, not of securities for investment purposes, but by third parties of securities in the Tortoise Funds or the Adams Funds. That's what's done on the New York Stock Exchange. That has nothing to do with Tortoise or Adams. They're not involved in those transactions. I think one of the district court cases we cite, the Gilson case out of the Southern District of New York, says the listing on the stock exchange is no activity with regard to the issuing company.
Well, it's some activity in terms of where you put your shares up for sale, right?
We don't put the shares up for sale
directly. You're participating in an exchange where they're purchased, right?
We do
take it off the New York Stock Exchange, I guess. Is that true?
We do list the shares on the New York Stock Exchange. That is true, but we're not participating in any transaction on those shares. What happens is you would have, which long before Tortoise ever, SAPA ever became a shareholder, you'd have an initial public offering. The underwriters purchase the shares. They then sell the shares to the initial group.
So if somebody who purchases the shares wants to sue you over the terms you attach to the shares, where do they have to go?
Depends on what their lawsuit is, I think, Your Honor. I mean, in some respects, they might have to go to Maryland or to Kansas, where there are exclusive forum provisions about suits regarding corporate governance.
Okay, what about the argument about venue that actually you transact business in New York because your business is buying and selling securities?
Okay, the business there is the buying and selling of securities by the funds for themselves, not with regard to the shareholders. And there you've got the question of what's the record? There's no record evidence to support that. And I heard Mr. Musica said our own affidavits admit that we do that. If you look at the affidavits, and the affidavits are in the-
Well, your affidavits admit that you are engaged in the business of buying and selling securities, right?
Yes.
And you have brokers in New York.
No.
You don't.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. What I do know the answer to is if you
but
read-
But where are you buying and selling all the securities?
It's largely done through decisions made by the Adams Fund in Maryland and by the Tortoise Funds.
Okay, and when they make that decision, to whom do they communicate the instructions?
They will use brokers, but we-
And there's brokers in New York?
There's nothing in the record on that, Your Honor. If you read the declarations, and if you read, for example, the declaration that was submitted on the Tortoise one.
If the brokers were in New York, would that mean that you're transacting business?
Well, then what you get into, you look at the Sacofany case, and you look at the Kodak case, and they talk about you're looking at the ordinary business, everyday ordinary business of the funds, and the transaction of business, at least for purposes of the investment company, it has to be of a substantial character. I submit that requiring something of a substantial character means you've got to assess the quality, quantity, and characteristics of that business.
I mean, if your business is buying and selling securities, and you might be making the decisions in Maryland, but you're on the phone transmitting those instructions to your broker in New York all day, is that a substantial part of your
I don't think so. I think and that's a question of what is the business of one of these funds. I would submit that the business of the funds is the strategic management of an investment portfolio. It's the decision.
That happens in Maryland. Yeah.
That happens for Adams in Maryland. It happens for Tortoise in Kansas. That's where they've got their own traders there. What the record doesn't show, and Daniel says you need to do a realistic evaluation of the business of the defendant. And that was never done. And the problem you have here is SABA files a motion for summary judgment when it files the complaint. In the complaint, when I hear that their claim arises out of the shareholder rights, if you look at paragraph one of the complaint, paragraph one specifically says, if I can get my fingers working, this civil action, quote, arises from the fund's adoption of provisions in their governing documents purporting to opt into the Control Share Act. The affidavits say that was done by the boards in the Tortoise situation in Kansas, in the Adams situation in Maryland. So the cause of action they assert in a complaint arises out of what's in Maryland. The issue about what the brokers do or don't do, there's nothing in the record.
Okay, I get that. Do you have a view on the district court's reliance on the notion that when the statute authorizes nationwide service of process that you can look at connections with the whole country?
I think that's a good question, Your Honor, because what I look at with the Supreme Court decision in the state law long-arm jurisdiction cases, the Supreme Court's basically cutting back on that and saying you've got to have some real nexus between the claim. You ought to have general jurisdiction where they're at home, so that either place of incorporation or headquarters, principal place of business, or if you're going to use specific jurisdiction, there's got to be some nexus. And that's what the venue provision does in connection with the nationwide service of process. It tries to put that connection in there in some way in the transacting of business. And the problem that you have here is that was never analyzed, what business these funds did in New York for purposes of either venue or jurisdiction. I heard that the inferences get drawn in favor of SABA in this, but they don't on summary judgment. And so it's always the burden of the plaintiff to establish the existence.
Because it's their motion, you're saying.
What?
Because it's their motion.
It's their motion for summary judgment. It's one thing for Judge Rakoff to say on a motion to dismiss, I'm going to deny the motion, because you get into this question of whether they get a prima facie case and how you draw inferences, and you draw the inferences against the non-moving party. But on summary judgment, you draw the inferences in favor of us. So you can't take an affidavit that doesn't say something and draw an inference that it does say that.
Okay. I think we have that argument. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Webb,
thank you very much.
Last rebuttal, so the case is submitted, and because that is our last